The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
All right. Well, hi, everybody. And thanks very much for tuning into our third NASP podcast. We've done a couple already about, what is a degenerative disc and, painful versus non-painful. And we talked about maybe sources of pain. But really, the elephant in the room is, how do you know which disc is painful based on contemporary imaging and patient presentation? So today's topic is really going to be all about imaging with a view to trying to sort out which disc is painful. So on that note, we'll get started. I'm Dr. Mark Irwin. I'm an assistant professor in Division of Orthopedic and Neurosurgery at the University of Toronto. And I'd like to introduce my colleague, Dr. Zori Busser from the Gerling Institute. And she's an assistant professor at NYU Orthopedic Surgery. And we have a special guest with us, Dr. Jeff Lotz from UCSF. And maybe Zori, I'll pass on to you for a brief second to talk about yourself, and then we'll pass on to Jeff.
Absolutely. Really great to have everyone back. And thanks to everyone who's joining today's podcast and staying with us. As Mark said, I'm here at Gerling Institute and Department of Orthopedic Surgery at NYU. And I've been a member of several NASP committees for a very long time. And as Mark, really excited to have Jeff, who's been in the field for very long and looked at low back pain from various perspectives. So for our podcast, it's a really important speaker to have. Jeff?
Thank you, Zori. Nice to see you all. My name is Jeff Lotz. I'm a professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of California at San Francisco. And, just briefly, I've studied low back pain for approximately 30 years or so and have evolved in terms of my perspectives on where I focus. I started out looking at mostly spine biomechanics. I was a bioengineer by training, and so computational modeling, material testing was kind of an initial focus, and then began to evolve into looking at animals and preclinical models, in vitro models of disc degeneration, because things obviously evolve with biology, and biomechanics by itself doesn't incorporate that. So we began to focus on animal models of degeneration. And as we started then to look at therapies, which includes biologics, it became apparent that we didn't know how to distinguish a painful degenerative disc versus a non-painful degenerative disc. And that obviously has important consequences for the mechanism of action of a therapy. And so as we're thinking about how do we optimize a therapy, we had to then decide, well, what is it we're optimizing the therapy to do? And so that's what kind of got us into looking at where pain generators may be in the disc with histology, some animal models, and then trying to use imaging as a bridging tool to link features that we attributed to pain in discs that had damage or degeneration, and how do we then look at that in patients? And so that's kind of gotten us to where we've tried to bridge diagnostics and therapies because of their circular reliance. If you put the right therapy in the wrong disc in the wrong patient, it's not going to work, right? And vice versa. So if you don't have the right mechanism of action for the particular pathology, you're going to miss there. And so as we're trying to advance these biologic technologies, which are pretty sophisticated, it was apparent that the diagnostic technologies were pretty crude. And so we wanted to try to, how do we align this level of sophistication in both the diagnosis and the targeting and the therapy? And so that's kind of what's gotten me to the work that we're doing now. So thanks for including me.
Well, it's great to have you, Jeff. So let me ask you then, it's a perfect segue, thank you. So to date, we've got plain film imaging, we have CT, we've got MRI, and in terms of diagnosis, there's provocative measures like discography or anesthetic discography, which has its own limitations, the possibility of inducing degeneration downstream and so on. So really we have a lot of difficulty in trying to determine where the pain is. So can you talk to us a little bit about what you see as novel, non-invasive kind of methods to evaluate where the pain is coming from in a disc?
Yeah, there's a number of approaches that we've been investigating. And, these are some off-the-shelf techniques that may be available, and then some novel techniques that were being developed from the perspective of we think we know where the particularly as I mentioned, out of these, some of these animal preclinical studies, you know, what is the source of pain? Is it chemical? Is it, you know, the neuroinnervation damage? So, you know, we're fortunate to be at a university where there's tremendous radiology expertise and advanced technologies. And so we have been trying to take advantage of those. And, you know, the dilemma is how do you validate a diagnostic technology against a potentially defective predicate, you know, a reference standard? And you mentioned provocative discography. And is, you know, if that's kind of the best we have in terms of a provocative test that's used to localize which disc is painful, you know, that was one that we decided to use. And, you know, how do we then use provocative discography as a way to advanced technologies that might be able to replace that in terms of its invasiveness. So one idea that came out of some discussions at UCSF, the real, actually with folks who image brain, is using magnetic resonance spectroscopy. And as you know, you all know from Jill Urban and others' work that, you know, the disc is anaerobic and there's lactic acid production when disc cells get into trouble. And so we thought, well, gee, it'd be interesting if we could do some metabolic imaging of the disc that would then add that chemical or metabolic data to, you know, more traditional data on matrix, you know, proteoglycan, collagen, things like that. So we started with some, you know, early studies looking at samples of disc tissue from patients and, you know, began to see that there were features in spectra, chemical spectra from discs that we could at least initially associate with what the clinical diagnosis of a painful versus non-painful level. So we spent a number of years, because it's not a trivial thing to do, particularly there's a signal and noise problem of you know, trying to match, you know, to get these data collected in a reliable way on patients. But then ultimately conducted studies, training, because you have a chemical signature, which is this, you know, complex data set. And then you want to train that to a binary painful, non-painful diagnosis. And so using discography, that purpose, you know, we conducted some studies to come up with an algorithm that allowed us to convert a spectra to a painful versus non-painful diagnosis by discography, which looks quite promising. The other thing about it, which gets to not only the where, but the why, I think this is important of, you know, where the pain is coming from, but also if there's information about, you know, why that pain might be apparent, that also is important for thinking about therapies. And the spectroscopy has, you know, the thing that was key from that the measurement is the looking at a combination of these metabolite markers, lactate and propionate, which is kind of a separate story about anaerobic organisms and potential, you know, disc microbiome as a factor, and proteoglycan. And so if you look at the ratio of those two, you know, we saw that there was a disproportionate shift in low proteoglycan, high lactic acid and discs that were positive by discography. And so we were excited by that. And the challenge then gets to be, how do you validate that prospectively? And so we've been looking at clinical outcomes, primarily initially at surgery. So if you, we collect spectroscopy data at baseline, as the clinician goes about their business of doing treatment, fusion or disc arthroplasty. And then we look at endpoints afterward to see if, you know, how well the patients did, whether the treatment level missed or matched the one that was diagnosed with spectroscopy. And you see, you know, evidence that you do a lot better if you pick the levels that are positive with spectroscopy, particularly in its, you know, subtle adjacent levels. That's always that question I get, is if I know I'm going to fuse L5-S1 because it's got a, you know, degenerative spondylolisthesis, how do I know if I should treat the next level? And so this can be helpful in that regard. So that's a technology that we're looking at, you know, the implementation science side. That's, I think, the other stumbling block is when we look at things in the academic medical center, you know, the translation into clinical practice is not trivial. And particularly if you're an academic or a clinical site that doesn't have, you know, the latest and greatest sequences and collaborators, you're not going to be able to do this stuff. So we're trying to come up with an infrastructure that allows, you know, the everyday clinician to have access to this stuff. So the other technologies have come out of our interest in end plate pain. You know, one of the things that we learned from the cadaveric studies was the area where we found the most innervated damage in human cadavers is at the vertebral disc interface, the end plate. And the end plate, I've always thought of as kind of the forgotten stepchild, because you have the disc-focused people who look at soft tissue and nucleus and annulus, and then the bone people who think about the bone for osteoporosis and vertebral fracture. And the end plate is kind of the piece in between that nobody really looks at. And at that hard soft tissue interface, there's really a lot that's happening that I think is really interesting biologically and biomechanically. And so what we started to really hone in on based on those anatomic studies was, that's where the action is. And so can we, better develop ways of characterizing end plate damage and the associated bone marrow edema, because it's common, and we're getting more convinced that, these motor lesions, bone marrow lesions, are a phenotype that's important for thinking about treatments. And so what is it about that damage, that interface, that leads to, fibrovascular change in the bone marrow? And so that's this, we've learned that there's this crosstalk between nucleus cells that normally aren't exposed to bone marrow, and because they're sequestered there since you were born. And then once you have damage, you get this crosstalk that can trigger these pro-inflammatory changes in bone marrow. So so some of that you can see with traditional imaging. Motor lesions is something I'm sure most people have heard about, but they're kind of somewhat subjective. And we found that there's a lot of damage and fibrovascular change that kind of is below the threshold of detection with standard clinical imaging. So we asked the question, can we get at that more accurately with some advanced techniques? And one that we like, it looks promising, is a water fat fraction imaging. So we can get kind of a footprint of bone marrow composition and the ratio of fatty bone marrow versus non-fatty bone marrow is, and you can see these bone marrow lesions light up. So you get much better contrast, visual contrast. So some of the work that Aaron Fields is doing now through the Backpack Initiative is asking the question, can we train using advanced analytics, an algorithm that would extract more accurate bone marrow lesions using maybe clinical imaging, but using ideal fat fraction imaging as the reference standard. So maybe we can, if people generally don't have access to fat fraction imaging, maybe we can train something to pull that information out of standard imaging. So that's, I think, something that people will be seeing more about. The last thing I'll mention before I you guys speak is, getting back to the end plate. The other thing that we've gotten interested in is the end plate cartilage really is the gatekeeper in terms of transport from, blood, glucose, and oxygen, and capillaries that sit under the cartilage end plate and the vertebra and disc cells in the nucleus. And so changes in the composition of that end plate cartilage is the primary driver, we think. It's not, particularly in the central end plate, it's not like you're getting sclerosis of the subchondral bone and that's creating the coffin effect, but the composition of the end plate cartilage is changing. And Aaron Fields and others at UCSF have shown that with human end plate cartilage samples, there's quite a variability in their transport properties. And you can see that with ultra short time to echo MRI. So one of the other projects we have right now is looking at end plate composition this UTE imaging and asking the question, does discs that are degenerative, are they disproportionately affected by poor end plate transport? And where we think that's important is if you're going to inject a biologic, and if you're trying to resuscitate a nucleus, you're by definition increasing metabolic activity, which requires proportionate glucose and oxygen and waste lactic acid transport to end plate capillaries. And if you've got an end plate cartilage that's not going to allow that, then your biologic therapy is likely going to not be successful. So, should you, in parallel with a biologic and to amp up disc metabolism, should you in parallel depermeabilize the end plate that facilitates transport that would be suitable for increased cellular activity? And so you think about some of the biologics now where they're, doubling, tripling cell density in the nucleus, that comes at a cost, and you can't just do that and expect the rest of the system to accommodate necessarily. So, we're looking at whether we have evidence that end plate cartilage could be a target for a companion treatment to support a biologic. So that's another area where I think there'll be things published that people I think be interested in.
that right?
Yeah. So, Jeff, you brought up a lot of good points. So I'm glad that you talked about end plate, because very often we just focus on the disc itself. And if we fix the disc and inject enough cells and growth factors, everything is going to work out. But as you said, imaging is one of our main guides to potentially which discs might be good candidates for regenerative treatments and hopefully preventing surgery. As you said, a lot of imaging is at academic centers that is not easily, readily available to become a standard of care where patients can be easily diagnosed, not easily necessarily, but for us to push biologics right. into the regenerative field. So if you had to look at all the different types of imaging that we currently have for both disc and end plate, which ones are closest, do you think, that could be widely applicable?
I think I see it as a you have a continuum where, you know, you have the Pinto version of diagnostics, routine clinical imaging, and then you got the Cadillac versions on the other side that you can get at specialty, you know, imaging centers or academic institutions. And, you know, the challenge is, what's the right amount? It's kind of a Goldilocks problem. You know, what's the right amount of imaging information that you need? And I think that's, we're trying to answer that question in the BACPAC collaboration, which I'll maybe talk about in a minute. But, you know, and you can maybe bridge that gap with some fancy machine learning, AI kinds of approaches. But I see that there's a, you know, I, you know, my view is that you do have, you know, nociceptive irritation. And, you know, the combination of when you have damage around the disc, you get healing, which is there's weakened material properties. So when you load the disc, those tissues stretch because they're not, you know, they're damaged and healing. And so you've got this mechanical strain plus those areas that might have neoinnervation, which is chemically sensitized by this crosstalk between the nucleus and outer tissues. That combination is what I think is really the nut of what is causing, you know, not necessarily trying to change the language, just not discogenic pain per se, but I think it's, you know, whether it's vertebrogenic or end plateogenic, but it's, you know, the disc itself, it's not as though nerves are totally repopulated in the nucleus. It's the, you know, the nerves are really all staying at the periphery. And I think to answer your question, I think that the, you know, being able to assess both the chemical signal, which is a measure of chemical sensitization, I think spectroscopy is kind of the only thing that has that metabolic information that is not just structural. It's not just the bricks and mortar of the disc, but it tells you something about what the cells are doing that might have you know, producing these inflammatory or pro-inflammatory chemicals that might cause nociceptive irritation. So that I think is important. And then I think, you know, the modic lesions are kind of a biomarker of this pro-inflammatory crosstalk. So I think that, you know, those two, and one of the things we'll hopefully see in a BACPAC is how do those co-associate? Is a better measure of modic lesions with, let's say, ideal MRI or a trained clinical MRI, you know, is that independent from a spectroscopy signal with lactic acid in the nucleus, or are they basically, you know, the acid signal is triggering the modic lesion, so they're all related, and one might they're overlapping measures and not independent measures, and that's something that we'll look to identify. We have been working to make accessible spectroscopy, and in order to do that, we formed a company that. It's now called Aclarion. I'll need to disclose as I've gotten some involvement in that. And the challenge there is kind of what you got at, Zori, is how do these sequences get in the hands of clinicians? And that allows us both to learn whether the utility is really there, because we get many more real world examples in cases that are complicated, where these tools might be helpful for clinicians to disentangle. And so that, you know, that so the work there has been, you know, getting sequences on scanners. Right now it's a Siemens scanner. There's commercial relationships with imaging centers, and so, you know, if a clinician is in the neighborhood of a, you know, a current Siemens scanner, it's likely that these software to do the spectroscopy is there, and there's some post-processing that has to happen. So, you know, all of that is packaged in a way so that you know, you do the image and the clinician gets a report and then hopefully they make a decision. And so I, you know, it could be that that infrastructure, which is kind of like a software in a cloud, you know, can layer on other imaging tools. So can you get other imaging measures from an MRI session that can then be brought into, and it's a companion to spectroscopy. So that may be something in the future as we learn, you know, the additive value of, you know, for example, it's why stop at the disc and the vertebra? Let's look at the paraspinal muscles and let's look at, you know, some anatomic measures of lordosis. And so that you can imagine that there's more and more information that could be integrated. And so as a, you know, as a goal of backpack, you know, we want to look at all those measurements together and then decide what's the most, what's optimum combination of measurements in addition to, you know, others that, that we can discuss for, you know, prioritizing, you know, when a patient might get a particular treatment and where that treatment should go based on what the measures tell you about mechanism of action and, you know, alignment with the treatment that you think is going to be appropriate.
Yeah. And that's a good point, Jeff. So we can define the level of this degeneration changes in the end plate, as you said, the muscle, but then at the end of the day, no patient is the same. And sometimes patients don't have a grade 4 degeneration and modic changes, but yet they have low back pain. So right. Have you, what is your opinion on risk factors, psychosocial in particular? Yeah. Because in the surgical setting, very often we have a list of modifiable, non-modifiable risk factors that correlate yeah. with surgical outcomes. So what do you think when, as we are diving further and deeper into regenerative treatments and potentially yeah. why some have failed in the past?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, it's clear that, you know, back pain is a complex chronic condition, which means it's complex and it's not just one particular thing in one particular patient. So what we've been approaching in Backpack Under the Heel initiative is looking more broadly, collecting measures that, you know, are captured in the biopsychosocial model, you know, that's kind of the three legs of the stool being you've got the, you know, perceptive, nociceptive piece, which we've kind of been talking about with imaging as a way to look for sources of nociception. And then you've got the cognitive, evaluative, and then you've got the behavioral, affective, motivational. And so those three things, you know, maybe more dominant in one patient than another. And that's, I think, where you have to customize, because it may be a patient's got a much more of a, you know, a belief, attitude, component that needs to be addressed with cognitive behavioral therapy or other kinds of therapies, and less so a pain generator that you can see that needs treatment in the back. And so how do these all fit together? And I think that you can't, and ultimately, I don't think you can really understand the value of one unless you look at them all together. And so that the challenge, and you've got so many measurements, and so how do we prioritize which measurements should be collected, how those measurements should be brought together in some kind of a an algorithm that looks at, you know, particularly staging, because you may say that, you know, at baseline you see the patient, you know, there's a collection of measurements and it tells you, okay, here's where this may be the most pressing area of intervention for this patient, but then, you know, that's going to evolve. You target that and then it might evolve. And so there's likely going to be these stage measurements. So the goal of Backpack is to, you know, develop, you know, if, and I think if Backpack is successful, there'll be a kind of a recommended set of measurements that capture this whole spectrum of, you know, social determinants, you know, systemic inflammation, you know, cognitive, behavioral, you know, the biomechanical, you know, getting, because the spine obviously is a biomechanical structure that needs to be stabilized. And there's a lot of things that go into doing that. So I think all of those measurements could have value in an individual patient. The challenge is what's the recommendation for implementation of that in a clinical setting. So that's what we're hoping to do.
This is, look, Jeff, this is fascinating. It's unfortunate the podcast can't go a couple hours. There's so much to talk about here. You know, like, for example, you know, we talk about the end plate and the disc, like, when's it too late? And does the biologic therapy introduced into the disc, does that permeate or diffuse into the end plate? Does that have potential positive effects? And to your point, all these studies injecting millions of stem cells into a disc, how can that possibly survive? There's so much to talk about. But I hope our listeners, we should probably wrap up soon. We're probably close to our time. But from all our listeners, I think it's been a great session. And I wanted to thank Jeff so much for his expertise and experience here helping us with this. And Zori, any other thoughts from you before we wrap up?
No, I think we've really covered everything, and it's a great introduction to our next podcast.
Yes, indeed. So everybody, please tune into our next couple. We've got another one coming up about disc repair techniques, annular closure, things like this. And then we'll have another one on biologics and why haven't they worked, which I think will dovetail very nicely with what Jeff so eloquently showed us today. And we may even be talking about modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors as well. So we're hoping by the time these podcasts are all done, we'll be able to provide you with kind of a fairly decent snapshot of the legacy of problems faced by treating painful back problems. And so anyway, with that, I'll thank everybody again very much for watching. And again, Jeff, thanks so much for helping us today. It's a pleasure to see you and talk with you. And Zori, thank you very much. And with that, I guess we'll close things off for now, and we'll look forward to seeing you all next time.